Hi, welcome to Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, provided by Shoshin Works in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. I'm your host, Ed Powell. I'm the CEO of TensorX. We sit at the intersection of the cloud, the crowd, and AI to drive innovation. I'm thrilled to be joined by my co-host today, James Villarubia. I'll pass the mic over to him to introduce himself.
Thanks, Ed. My name is James Villarubia. I'm a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA currently. I have a background in government policy and social impact startups and AI. And my first startup actually was in the educational technology space. So I'm really excited to be here with our guest today and dig into this topic. Back to you, Ed.
As organizations try to keep pace with the rapid evolution of technology, drawing on different perspectives in relation to education becomes imperative. Agility is becoming increasingly important as a tool to upskill and reskill within the work landscape. In partnership with innovations created to build active learning experiences, through this, training has become more modernized, with the potential to be faster and more effective while utilizing a data-driven approach in order to improve outcomes that matter. As we kick off our new podcast series, I'm excited to dive into the topic of the future of education and what that learning infrastructure looks like. We're thrilled to be sitting down with Andrew Powell today to discuss this topic, as he does important work in order to revolutionize how we learn. Welcome, Andrew. Please introduce yourself and your background in education.
Thank you. Great to be here. So I'm Andrew Powell. I'm the founder and CEO of Learn to Win. We're an education technology platform that is driving agile last mile training for organizations. We'll talk about what we mean by those terms. I've been really fascinated by the future of education for the past 10 years. I got started actually as an undergraduate at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, working with professors to redesign how their classes were taught using various active learning approaches and technologies. I then spent 3 years helping to build a new university system called African Leadership University throughout sub-Saharan Africa, and then went to Stanford Business School to do my MBA, which is where I got started working on Learn to Win in earnest. So pleased to be here today to talk about a topic I really care about.
That's awesome. So can you tell us a little bit about sort of, I think listeners would be really excited to hear about the African Learning University, and then maybe a little bit about Learn to Win, so we have sort of a context of the space within education that you've been tackling for your career.
Sure. So starting with ALU, the mission that we were on was to build the future of universities on the African continent in a way that is affordable, accessible, and really creates an opportunity for folks who traditionally don't have access to quality higher education options or can't afford them to receive a degree that equips them to get a good job, provide for their families, make an impact in their community. So a really ambitious project was founded by a guy named Fred Swanaker, who's been an education entrepreneur, having founded the African Leadership Academy before the university system. And my role there was learning innovation lead. So I was really thinking about how do we build a scalable system of delivering really high quality university courses at a price point that's affordable for the African middle class. And so a big challenge, we really thought about ourselves as kind of disrupting higher education to deliver, differentially better learning outcomes that are tied to equipping people for the workforce and for, their careers in the future, whether it was going to be in business or in politics, and trying to do all of that in a way that is scalable and affordable and equitable. So that was a tremendous experience. I'm pleased to say it's still going really well. When I started there, we were just about 5 or 7 people that were sitting in an office building with a bunch of whiteboards. And now there's accredited universities in 3 different countries. There are tens of thousands of learners scattered across the continent. And a couple years ago, they got about a $450 million grant to expand to a number of additional locations. So yeah, just a tremendous experience being at the African Leadership University, and encouraging the listeners to check it out online. It's alueducation.com. And I think it really presents, a vision of what higher education could be in a lot of other countries too. I think while, the challenges in higher ed are perhaps more acute in a place like Rwanda, which only has 8 to 10% higher ed attainment across the country, the lessons learned about how can you drive, more effective education at a more affordable price point have relevance certainly in the States, where we have, huge student debt challenges. It's about how do we equip people for the future of work. What role does a higher education system play in all of that? I think it's it's kind of an interesting laboratory of innovation to look at a place like Rwanda and see how they're innovating to meet a lot of the same challenges that, you know, we face as a country.
And it sounds like you were really sort of at the, you know, not quite ground floor, but close enough that sort of really helped scale that organization dealing with really hard challenges. And from what I understand, sort of you took, I guess you took a lot of those learnings about sort of scale and innovation and sort of rethinking the sort of American education system or corporate education system and sort of brought that to your new work. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
For sure. Yeah, that's exactly the transition that happened. So the big ideas that we were grappling with is how can you first develop the most effective learning experience possible? And then how can you deliver that anywhere in the world? And so starting with the kind of how do we develop the most effective learning experiences possible, we really looked around the world for inspiration, certainly some of the great institutions like Harvard or Stanford, but then other startup universities, accelerators, job training programs. So we kind of pulled all that inspiration to develop our curriculum and our approach at ALU. And to make kind of a long story short, a lot of the findings was really that the way that you teach, the methods that you use, and then the technologies you can use to support that matter a whole lot more than just who the teacher is or kind of what their background is. And so we found that if we were able to piece together the curriculum that a world-leading instructor at another institution had built, and then we train someone with all of the most effective pedagogical approaches on how to deliver that course really well, they could teach a intro CS class in, or computer science in Kigali, Rwanda, you know, as well as the introductory course you might get at Princeton in terms of the student learning outcomes, in terms of how prepared they are for taking on the next courses. And you can do that really at a fraction of the cost, leveraging, you know, online education, active learning approaches, personalized feedback, high structured practice, you know, a lot of different tools and techniques. But the challenge that we ran into in, or I guess that I ran into in designing this curriculum and then delivering it is we were having to cobble together a whole bunch of different platforms and tools that weren't really purpose-built for the use case that we had, the kind of traditional learning management system that really wasn't built for the type of learning experience we were trying to drive, or the authoring platforms we were using really equipped for the mobile delivery modality that our students kind of demanded, giving some of the bandwidth and infrastructure challenges on the continent, and a host of other things that were just challenging to piece together the different technologies necessary. And so that's a big part of where the idea for Learn to Win came from, was could we make a platform that's really purpose-built for the highly effective active learning experiences we were trying to design and deliver? And can we make it so fast and easy to use that you don't have to have a whole instructional design team with decades of experience to design and deliver a really effective learning experience? But if you're just a one-person L&D team in a company, or a single instructor who's designing a new course at a university, or even in some cases, you know, a football coach who's trying to teach your team as effectively as you can to prepare for it, that platform just makes it so easy for you to build those learning experiences, deliver it to your people, and then sort of optimize it through the data tools that we offer. So that was the inspiration for Learn to Win, kind of based on that acute problem that we felt at ALU, and then some of the opportunities that we saw in the market.
So, I mean, that's great. I mean, it seems like a lot of sort of the learnings from sort of the old and traditional models and what's how we're adapting seem sort of almost a better fit, or at least a more scalable fit for some of the corporate learning. But can you talk about, for our audience, a little bit about sort of the differences between maybe the general skills that maybe sort of ALU or sort of online learning sort of kind of broader liberal arts, quote unquote, learning it might be tackling versus maybe some of the firm or company specific skills. And maybe just not, maybe if there are pedagogical differences, we'll talk about that, but at least some content wise or offering wise, and what are the challenges or differences between the two?
For sure. Yeah, I think the initial interest for me in a lot of these learning ideas was really in the methods of teaching. You know, how do you teach most effectively towards some goal, whether it's Econ 101, how do we teach people as well as we can to perform as well on the final assessment as possible? But as we've gotten into a lot of our work with corporations, I think the question of what you're teaching in the first place is perhaps even more important. And that's where we've really noticed a big divergence between, as you mentioned, the general skills, which might be, you know, the foundational things that anybody needs to know to work in sales, versus the firm-specific skills where it's, in one case, Regeneron is a customer of ours. And if you're going to be an effective sales rep at Regeneron, you need to be extremely well-versed in their Dupixent drug, say that that's the one that, you know, you're selling. which involves tons of chemistry and biology and the medical mechanism of action of what indications that drug works for, what places it doesn't work. And you have to be really well equipped in all of the specific things that are unique to Regeneron, perhaps even proprietary to that organization. And that's where I think a lot of the gap exists right now in the market. If you look at the general skills, there's been a ton of innovation really since kind of the internet, where you have places like Coursera or Khan Academy or Learning, who are providing really great, high quality learning experiences for those common things that are, you know, generally the same across an industry. But the area that I think is the next big place of innovation is how do companies design and deliver and then train their people in all of the unique things that are completely specific to their organization. But the research recently has shown that even though that is kind of the big gap, a lot of times the firm-specific skills actually account for about 80% of your job performance. And so it's a massive unmet need in our belief. And that's why, you know, at Learn to Win, we've been really focused on trying to fill that gap with a suite of tools that can equip companies to very quickly build very effective firm-specific skill training.
That's great. You talked about a lot of different tooling sort of mechanisms in the ecosystem, and I'm familiar with a few, and you mentioned some players in the space, Coursera, Khan Academy, et cetera. I think a lot of those operate or have operated, I think most people coming to EdTech would assume there's some efficiencies of scale, sort of the low-hanging fruit from a technological standpoint. What are the other sort of nuanced views of sort of how technology in the future or sort of the trends in technology as a sort of scaling problem in EdTech can be resolved? Because, I mean, I think you present with firm-specific technology or firm-specific learning a different flavor of that. If you can't necessarily reuse the same content, where else do you achieve efficiencies? How do you drive to the sort of greater ROI?
Yeah, it's a great question. So being really interested in kind of learning and the learning sciences, there's this famous problem that gets to the question of scale, which is Bloom's two sigma problem. So Benjamin Bloom, a notable education researcher, did this study where he compared traditional group instruction, where you have one teacher and 30 students, to two different mechanisms of instruction. One is one-on-one tutoring, which would be kind of not terribly scalable at all. And then another was a group instruction modality that used a technique called mastery learning. And essentially what he found was the mastery learning methodology for the group was one standard deviation better in terms of learning outcomes than the traditional instruction. But then the one-on-one tutoring was two standard deviations better than the group instruction. And so there's kind of always been this problem, I suppose, in learning science as well as kind of education technology more broadly is there some way that you can deliver the quality of the one-on-one tutoring at the scale of the, you know, 1-to-30 or even greater ratio? And if you look back at the early days of Coursera or Khan Academy, a lot of times their founders talked about trying to solve the, you know, Bloom's two sigma problem through this, you know, online learning that could perhaps be more effective than a, you know, individual human instructor through data science or AI or various different approaches. And I think there likely is promise for that. But I think a lot of the challenge is if you're still doing a one-to-many approach and it's not contextualized to the specific, you know, learning needs of an individual or the particular goals of an organization, then the quality of the instruction might be really good. But if it's still just one-to-many, then it's not getting the personalization that's necessary to really drive the outcomes that you're going for. You know, if you're really good at teaching everybody those foundational sales skills, but then you don't get that last bit of information that is relevant to your particular team, your particular product, your particular competitive landscape, then ultimately that person's not going to succeed in the role. They might perfectly pass your sales, you know, assessment test, or they might get 100% on the preparatory course, but they're not going to succeed in their job. And so then thus it you know, falls short. So I think the kind of fine tuning piece is important. And it's not just about how effective the learning experience is, but it's if you maximize the effectiveness of the learning experience, does it lead to real world outcomes that matter, like succeeding on the job or hitting your sales quota or, you know, whatever the kind of organizational outcome is that matters beyond just the, you know, the learning assessments that happen. And I think that's a piece that is sometimes lost in the world of, you know, just looking at educational outcomes is, you know, yeah. If somebody passes a test at a certain level, that's great. It's probably better than failing the test. But if you actually pass that test, does it lead to something beyond that has significance in the real world?
Yeah, there's that tacit assumption you sort of referenced about sort of the test equals therefore, oh, I got a a great score in this standardized test, therefore. And I think if you look at sort of the research out there around standardized tests and college performance or careers, a lot of the, exiting high school tests that we're all familiar with don't actually correlate to much college success because there's so much variation. So the testing fundamental, testing tacit assumptions that are sort of baked into that are getting outdated now. And we're struggling to, I think, as a society, get to adaptive learning. But even with the word adaptive learning, mostly usually means adaptive testing, right? Testing to where the person is. Well, you're talking about adaptive learning, sort of taking that and bringing not only an optimization for the systemic goals, did they really perform better as opposed to just test better, but also sort of working that performance or performance failures or learning failures back into the pedagogy and course structure. So, I mean, you're closing out the loop at a much broader lens. Is that sort of a fair summary of the approach here?
For sure. For sure. And I think I'll just acknowledge here that a very big, hairy problem is, what is the purpose of education and what are the outcomes we should be going for? And I think there's really thoughtful arguments that can be made for a lot of different potential goals. My personal perspective on higher education is, one of the very key metrics we should be looking at is upwards economic mobility. I think that, ALU, that was our kind of core goal. Are we bringing in people who are from a lower income area and equipping them to go out and get a job that puts them, higher in the income distribution? And are we doing that kind of at scale and equitably? But, if you have a different goal of kind of equipping people to be thoughtfully engaged citizens in a democracy, well, let's figure out how do we actually measure whether we're doing that effectively. Let's not just kind of assume that because we, have people read Plato and discuss it in a Socratic seminar that suddenly they become, great citizens. Like, what do we even mean by great citizens? What are the behaviors and the outcomes that if it works, then it'll actually happen? And
so maybe if I, it's like, I just, and I want to pass off to Ed after this comment, but it sounds like, what you were sort of approaching was the ALU, some learnings there. You've brought to Learn to Win. You've expanded maybe the experimental set of questions, but within sort of the firm specific educational space, maybe it's a little easier to say the firm wants this, right? We have an ROI, we have a number of sales, but the learnings about how sort of that pedagogical loop sort of goes back could be really valuable to eventually extend into sort of higher ed or other sort of traditional ed places where maybe the outcomes are a little more discrete upon, but we at least have got some of the pedagogical structures in place. Sounds like you're, sort of setting up the next phase of educational technology here, which is sure. Awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, my core passions really lie in the learning questions and the educational problems. And I think if I forecast out my career, I definitely want to get back in kind of the K-12 higher ed, perhaps even educational policy realms. I will say in starting a venture-backed technology company, we needed to find a place where we could quickly get a product out in the market that people would pay for, that could scale. And so we did target companies as, the first problem to solve. They typically have a pretty clear utility function they're trying to optimize for, whether it's improving the performance of their workforce, improving their profitability, reducing errors in the field that lead to safety incidents. And usually there's, a CEO and a management structure that has a aligned set of incentives where if you can drive value in that, they're willing to pay for it. They're willing to expand the work that you do with. And unfortunately, in a lot of places in kind of higher education, there's not quite that aligned set of incentives or structure, which is a tricky problem to solve. I think at the time, we had the benefit of starting from scratch. So we could kind of set a pretty clear goal and hire people who are aligned to that goal. If you're a 200-year-old public institution, it may be a little bit harder to suddenly say, hey, we're going to completely change our, organizational strategy to be targeting this metric. So long-winded way of saying, yes, we started in corporate because I think we can quickly align the stakeholders around a vision of success that is kind of tying those learning inputs to the business outcomes. And if we demonstrate that we do that effectively, we can scale and we can, grow our revenues, grow our team, grow enterprise value, et cetera. But I do have a lot of interests and certainly some thoughts on the broader systemic questions too.
Yeah, my startup back in the day was started in K-12, and sort of that was probably a venture mistake, because the getting to sort of market penetration in K-12 is an 18-month sales cycle, and you might have 18 months of funding. So how K-12, how sort of early education, where there is a lot of need, there's clear some clear problems, but delivering that in a sort of venture-backed way is a difficult path. So, I think you made the right decision. But over to you, Ed, sorry.
Thanks, James. So when you look at the various segments in the market that you're addressing now, like, how do they measure the impact of Learn to Win, like before and after, or how they think about it, even in the sales cycle of you're making a pitch to them about what Learn to Win is going to do for them and measuring that ROI?
Yeah, great question. So we start from the initial conversations and a sale all the way through to any sort of pilot that we do and then a project implement. We start by asking that question of how are you going to know that this works and what are the business metrics that if we're successful, if you make wave a magic wand and we achieve all of these dreams, what's going to be different about your business on the other side? And that's where it's really specific to the organization. I mentioned Regeneron earlier. And the thing that we were really focused on with them is could we ramp their sales team to productivity faster than they did with their traditional approaches? Let's say that in the past, it took 5 weeks on average to ramp each of the 300 sales reps that were then going to take a new product to market. If through Learn to Win, through our active learning approaches, we can do that in 3 weeks, then that saves them, you know, 2 weeks across 300 people. That's some hard cost savings. And then if they're getting, you know, 97% on their assessments rather than 80%, then there's also probably a boost in productivity they'll see in the sales metrics that come out of that. To give a very different example, we did some work with the Navy where the metric we were trying to drive was actually a reduction in downtime for the E-2D Hawkeye due to maintenance issues. They were running into a number of issues with some fiber optic cabling that were just consistently creating problems on the flight line. And so we went in and we did an assessment of what was the knowledge gap that was leading to this performance issue, did some retraining based on what we found over the course of a month. And then we looked at the actual maintenance logs coming out of that of at the base where we had retrained the maintenance technicians, were they correctly identifying the issue on the first pass at a higher rate than people who hadn't been trained in our model? And then use that as the basis to then scale up our work with the Navy saying, hey, we've reduced your maintenance issues by this amount in this amount of time. And so it's a very clear ROI of just kind of hard savings and performance improvements, readiness gains that happen through that intervention.
Great. So like in the sports part of the business, are there other ways that they measure ROI or that they look at performance?
Yeah, I think kind of generally there's kind of time savings through greater efficiency in training. There's performance improvement through kind of doing things better than you had before, or there can be reduction in errors, like a really costly mistake. So a good one in sports that we often identify is saying, hey, you know, look at how many blown coverages, for example, you had last year. And a lot of teams actually grade this on a play-by-play basis. So the LA Rams, the customer of ours, they go through every single player, every single play, and give them a kind of plus, neutral, or minus score. Did you do the right thing? Did you do okay? Did you do something poor? And then they can, after implementing a product, you know, like ours, was there a, you know, reduction in the minuses and improvement in the pluses and the people that were trained in our methodology? And it's really interesting, you know, to see the way that by actually assessing rigorously the knowledge of players before they go and perform on the game, you can actually catch these potential mental errors before it results in a mistake. So for example, in one case, I won't name the team that had this, but they, you know, sent out a pregame quiz to their wide receivers, and the average score on that pregame quiz on a set of pretty simple questions of, you know, here's the play call, what route do you run? They got a 50% on average for their starters. And they did this, you know, 3 days before the game. And initially I saw that result and I was like, oh shoot, I guess they didn't learn the stuff that well and Learn to Win. Maybe we're, you know, not doing as well as I thought we could. But then I realized, like, absent using our products, they never would have known that there were these huge mental gaps until it actually resulted in a mistake on the field. And it, you know, in a highly competitive league where a single blown play could be the difference in a win or a loss, it was kind of cool to see that we had given them this key insight that, hey, you either need to pull that play out of the game plan, because if we call that, half of our wide receivers are going to screw it up, or we actually need to, you know, really focus our practice tomorrow and the next day to get ready for the game, because clearly, if unaddressed, this is going to be a big problem for us.
Yeah. So I to sort of follow up on that, it sounds like, I really love that NFL story. It really solidifies the problem. It felt like you have a process really baked in, focusing on sort of business outcomes and then sort of working backwards to identify gaps, then designing training. Because I know from the flip side, it seems to be sort of the more common approach of, I've got to have a training for some regulatory problem. Here are the things, the facts that they need to know. Okay, can they regurgitate the facts? They knew less of the facts before in the pretest. Now they know more of the facts. But it seems poorly set. A lot of sort of traditional LMS, you know, tools was set up for that. And it's hard to break out of that. It sounds like you guys are rethinking sort of the fine tuning element to be much more sort of KPI driven, which is being, you know, or business objective driven. Is that sort of a fair twist to your approach?
For sure. For sure. And I think this is kind of an industry wide change I think we'll see happen. There's often been a view of, say, learning and development departments within companies as these cost centers that are often some of the first places that get cut when there's an economic downturn. And we think instead it really should be viewed as sort of a strategic investment in improving the performance of the business. And it should be measured that way, where, you know, if you aren't accountable to some sort of KPI as a L&D department that actually connects to the performance of the business, then I think you really just don't know if what you're doing is working in the first place. And so it's a more challenging bar to hit of, instead of saying, you know, did we, in the Navy example, we could have just said, well, here was the pre-test on corrosion identification and here's the post-test. And once we implemented Learn to Win, it improved from the pre-test to the post-test. So they've learned more. So, you know, you should pay us and feel good about it. But it's like, let's actually go a step further and say, well, if you see that improvement in the post-test, is the assessment valid enough such that it actually leads to better job performance? And what would the job performance impact be? Well, it would be, you know, a change in the maintenance logs that show that these aircraft are like airworthy more often. And so being evaluated on that metric, I think is where you can actually demonstrate the impact of the learning, but then also help an organization to prioritize what investments they should make in learning in the first place. You know, if you think about an enterprise as complex as the US Navy, there's probably 10,000 different operational problems they could potentially try to go and solve. Which of those are worthy of a multi-million dollar investment, and which of those are kind of trivial enough that it doesn't actually matter for whatever our organizational goal is, which kind of comes down all the way from the national defense strategy of, I would say right now, it's readiness for a peer-to-peer conflict in the South China Sea or you know, somewhere around the world. So if that's the thing that we're trying to make sure we're constantly ready for, then you want to evaluate all the different potential investments you could make through some sort of logic model of what learning inputs are going to lead to the greatest organizational outputs that matter.
Yeah, I think that what it made me sort of think was the changing nature from sort of an optimization standpoint, from a corporate perspective, like what do they care about? And I guess that brought me to this, the thought of sort of the future of work. I mean, I think a lot of, not everyone, but a lot of corporations were really caught by surprise with the pandemic, and we're just not ready for this sort of remote work world. Thankfully, I think the technology was really sort of just on the cusp to sort of get us there and deliver the video and virtual conferences and things that also had sort of dramatic impacts within the educational spectrum, certainly for K-12 and for college. But can you talk a little bit sort of about your views of the future of work in sort of the context of education, of how companies, or how you're seeing companies sort of deal with remote work training or training that sort of starts to blend, you know, VR or AR, anything out there that's happening that is trying to get over the hump of this remote work that is adding to the sort of the agility that you're sort of pushing for or hoping for in the space?
Yeah. So I'll answer that in two ways. One, generally, I think the pandemic is a good example, but there's a lot of longstanding technological trends that are all creating this reality that kind of change is constantly happening and change is constantly accelerating. And as a result, the sort of disruptions that we're feeling in the workplace are probably going to just keep happening on a regular and even accelerating cadence. I think that'll be really accelerated by things like generative AI, which, similar to, you know, the steam engine or the internet or cloud computing, is kind of this massive sea change in technology that will just create massive economic disruptions in different ways. So there's this general trend of things are changing and they're ever accelerating, which then the question becomes, like, how does an organization keep pace with that change? And that's where I think the idea of agility is really essential. And the idea is, you don't necessarily need to predict what the future is going to be. You just need to make sure you're prepared to deal with whatever it brings. And that's where, when we're working with companies, a big part of our value prop is saying, hey, instead of, you know, a traditional learning and development process and a whole set of technologies where if you want to spin up a new course or a new program, it's going to take you 12 months and $500,000 and all of these different steps. You know, we were working with an organization that was building a new cybersecurity training program, and they were going to spend 18 months and a couple million dollars building it. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, by the time that it's published 18 months from now, it's already going to be 17 months out of date. because that's how quickly cybersecurity is changing. And the threats of, you know, the threats of 2 years ago are totally different from the threats of today. And so what's much more important than having a, you know, super high fidelity, totally obsolete training is a training that is delivered in days, not weeks, that's very easily changeable if the world, you know, changes and you now need to fix it. And that is much more kind of agile in the sense of we can, you know, quickly change. It's interoperable. It's modular. It is kind of decentralized rather than all centralized. And a lot of different design principles that, you know, have really worked in the world of software that we've learned over the course of, you know, 20, 30 years in terms of software development, I think apply similarly to our educational infrastructure and our training infrastructure that, you know, we really want to be designing, for example, microservices rather than monolithic architecture. You know, you want to think about the same thing in terms of your training enterprise. And so I think, yeah, that we've used the term agility and even the idea of agile learning because, you know, these are principles that I think are well understood and people agree upon in the world of software that I think similarly apply to the whole educational enterprise.
So what principles do you think organizations should apply to be really well suited to adapt to the future, the highly dynamic future needs, especially around training?
I think starting with an understanding of the business and kind of the core business logic of what are the problems that you want to solve, what are the strategic drivers you want to put in place, you know, understand kind of what winning looks like and define that outcome is one really key thing. And that may sound obvious, but it's kind of surprising to me how often that's not necessarily well articulated, well understood in an organization. I think you then want to do an assessment of where are we relative to where we want to be. And in our case, that is kind of a knowledge assessment that we tend to do where we actually, you know, send out quizzes and try and surface these different areas of knowledge gaps and then essentially rank the different gaps that we find in the organization, both the intensity of the knowledge gap, you know, do half of your people miss this key piece of information or lack this key skill? And then does that matter? Does it actually connect to some of the business outcomes that matter? To give like a hospitality example, we were working with a hotel where 80% of the people working in the restaurants didn't know a particular varietal of white wine that they served. And if in the one metric, like 80% of people missing the same question is a pretty, you know, big knowledge gap, but then the business impact of that is fairly minimal. Versus at that same hotel, we found that 20% of the people responsible for kind of settling guest bills didn't know a key step they needed to take. And they were leaving, in this case, hundreds of thousands of dollars kind of unaccounted for because of this one knowledge area. And so even though it was only a 20% knowledge gap, the business impact of that was massive. And so I think that's kind of the second step. And then the third piece, and this is really what our software enables, makes it super easy, is you want to make sure that you can build new training developed by subject matter experts very quickly in the matter of minutes or hours. I think this is where generative AI is going to be a huge breakthrough. Take something that used to take, you know, an entire day and turn it into a 5 minutes of editing and then deliver that to your people in kind of the flow of work on devices that are either in their pocket or accessible to in really effective and quick bites, and then analyze, did that lead to the knowledge change that we expected through a lot of assessments so that then you can bring it back up to that business logic. So I think that infrastructure, and then I guess kind of operationalizing it on either a daily or a weekly cadence in some sort of, you know, type scrum team or, you know, a weekly review of the knowledge gaps and the interventions that are happening, having that regular cadence of kind of performance improvement as just part of your operations of the business, I suppose, would be the final piece to tie all of those ingredients together.
That's great. I think that'll be very helpful to our listeners as they think about how they're going to create more agility, more kind of high-speed cycles, OODA loops in their own organizations. So you mentioned ChatGPT. What are you seeing in terms of how people are adapting to ChatGPT and other new technologies, and they're using it to drive this kind of agility?
Well, I think it really is going to be a massive change in the world. Folks out here in Silicon Valley are talking about it kind of on par with the internet or some of these other massive technological changes where, you know, the world is kind of one way before it and a totally different way after it. Within education, I think we're thinking about it in a couple different ways. One is certainly in the authoring of content. I think this is where, you know, if you go to ChatGPT right now, you plug in a whole textbook and then say, generate 100 multiple choice questions based off of this information, it can immediately spit out stuff that's pretty good quality. You know, you want to read through and edit it and review it, but it's really a dramatic accelerant for the kind of production of educational assessments or just information or, you know, a lot of different inputs for the generation of, I think the other place where it's maybe less the ChatGPT, but just sort of AI models more generally is in personalizing and optimizing the learner experience. I mean, this is something that, you know, in education, we've talked about personalization as a goal for a long time. My personal perspective is personalization shouldn't really be the goal. It should be optimization on a personal level. And what I mean by that is if you just personalize it to the preferences of a learner, but it doesn't necessarily lead to them performing maximally on the outcomes that matter, then the personalization is really just a insufficient stepping stone towards this broader goal of optimization. So I think that's a place where, you know, identifying across a massive set of data what the optimal next thing for someone to learn is to achieve the personal or organizational goal that matters is another area where AI could be really effective. And then the final piece, I think, is in some of these, you know, instructional modalities, personalizing the feedback that gets delivered, personalizing, you know, the time and place and cadence and duration of learning. There's a lot of other areas that we've kind of seen happen in social media, for example, the ways that Instagram will sort of, you know, create these dopamine loops that get you hooked on the product. I think some of those things, while perhaps a bit pernicious in some types of technology, if applied to education, could be a really interesting positive breakthrough in terms of just making learning a little bit more engaging or even addictive, dare we say. So yeah, those are probably the three areas that I think I'm pretty bullish on the impacts that AI can have within education.
Fascinating. I think I'll hand it back over to James now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ChatGPT instructions standpoint, I'm really intrigued by that because I think there's a lot of anxiety in the educational space around how it might be used. But one of the things you sort of talked about was sort of the agility, not just of sort of assessment and asking the right questions or identifying sort of the gaps, but also in sort of creating the right content. And I think do you see that as maybe the next evolution of sort of where education goes, is that we might have sort of AI generated tutors and AI generated, you know, voiceovers and people, and we can, you know, create imaginary people these days and give them voices and personalities. I mean, do you see that as maybe sort of the optimization standpoint is like, great, I can create content for you on the fly that will better address your knowledge gap than maybe the first set of information we gave you? I mean, do you see that as sort of the next evolution? Am I totally off base?
I do. I think if we jump back to the idea of Bloom's Two Sigma problem, I actually think there's an opportunity by combining, you know, human instructor plus an AI tutor or set of instructional technologies to outperform what a human one-on-one tutor is able to do. Because if you just think about what's a human really good at versus what's an AI really good at, you know, analyzing large sets of data to make a prediction about what the particular next step in a process should be, AI is likely to be better than even your best human tutor would be at making a prediction like that. But then on some things like helping cultivate a growth mindset in a learner, that's something that is educationally quite effective, good learning science around that. And perhaps a human, because of kind of social emotional cues or human biology or, you know, a variety of different factors, might actually always be better than an AI at generating that in a child. And that's maybe an open question. I don't, you know, perhaps the AIs will surpass us in all regards. I think there's likely an opportunity by just analyzing what are the sorts of things a really effective tutor does, which of these things do we think an AI might actually do better or at least on par with a human? And then if the AI takes all those things over, could that then free up the human instructor to really focus on the things that are uniquely possible for them to do? And might that combination of things actually lead to kind of educational outcomes for the learner that even surpass what Bloom thought was possible?
Right. So it's not necessarily about it's not about doing less education. It's about reducing the time spent on maybe see less fruitful mechanisms and saying, hey, if we can do the sort of the rote learning of this structure faster, then it gives more time for social and emotional learning, group activities, et cetera. Sort of the maybe a continuation of a flipped classroom model just to the next extent.
Exactly.
That's great.
Yep. So this has been fascinating. So Andrew, what would you like our listeners to come away with?
It's a great question. I think the idea of let's shift our thinking about education and learning from focused on the inputs and focused on the process, to instead start with the outcome that matters and then work backwards from that. I think that applies, you know, to tons of different organizational contexts. And even just asking that question can be pretty powerful, whether they, you know, decide to then put their existing resources towards a better set of things or change up some in their process. You know, starting with that question and then seeing where it leads you, I think is a really helpful place to start.
It's fascinating. So when I look at it, I think, you know, James and I always talk about this concept of economic triage. I think with Learn to Win, you have an idea of training triage, where you can find those high value opportunities to go embellish the productive capacity of people and enhance their lives and human flourishing in general. And I think it's fascinating what you're doing. And James, I'll turn it over to you. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for joining us, Andrew. I guess the biggest takeaway I have is the sort of that a concept of agility of learning. And I love that cybersecurity example. That's going to ring in my mind. The idea that you have to be able to train people as fast as the context in which they're operating is changing. You know, you can't spend 18 months or 12 months or 3 months training people up on something that's happening right now. And our ability to sort of adapt to that and meet that need is probably going to, you know, separate, you know, winners and losers in the marketplace for sure, because the marketplace is moving faster. Things are changing faster. So I think that's a really great takeaway for me, at least.
Yeah, there's so much to discuss here, and unfortunately, not any more time. So Andrew and James, thank you for your time today. Join us for future episodes that explore ecosystemic patterns that will help us better innovate, operate, and navigate in our increasingly connected world. Please subscribe to this podcast, and you can learn more at shoshinworks.com.